guns, flags, and forgiveness. Something changed in the month of June of 2015. It was unlike any June I remember in my whole life. Never mind the marriage thing, I'll get to that later. In South Carolina, our political leaders finally came together on an issue of social justice without having it forced upon them. Having change forced upon us is a tradition in South Carolina. Our state gave up slavery at gunpoint. It took the U.S. Supreme Court and a lot of court orders to end racial segregation in the schools. It took a constitutional amendment to give South Carolina women the right to vote. It took civil rights laws and more court orders to end segregation at restaurants, swimming pools, and other public accommodations. And it took a Voting Rights Act to give black people access to polls in South Carolina. It took multiple court orders to give same-sex couples the right to marry. It seems always the change seems to come from outside, forced upon us. Until now. That's why the coming together of our leaders on this issue of the flag represents a tipping point in the long arc of the universe that bends towards justice. In that long arc, a flag may seem a small thing fluttering in the breeze, but it's a big deal because some of our leaders were able to change their minds and focus on the needs of a hurting community and pour in a little balm, just a little. Just a little listening is what it took. But it's hard to jump up and down and cheer too jubilantly because this listening, this awakening, this backing down was won at a terrible cost. 9 men and women died in a church. A community was left bereft and grieving, and a nation in shock. Real people died for our sins. They didn't volunteer. They were there in that church for prayer and Bible study. Everything that we know about them in their final moments tells us they didn't hate. Even if they were all prayed up, they must have been afraid. But they didn't have guns, just their mindfulness and love. And they died trying to talk the killer out of the terrible thing he was about to do. And later, he said he was almost persuaded by their kindness. That killing was an ultimate act of self-separation. Self-separation. For that man, we're not all in this together. He did not understand that we are connected by an interdependent web of existence. He did not see that we are surrounded by love, cradled in love, all of us, in the arms of love. How do we respond? Do we partake of that same toxic gruel of separation? How do we acknowledge and respect the anger without becoming the thing we condemn? We can't help but be angry. Do we holler back at Facebook friends and call them idiot because they are uninformed on the issues that are dear to us? Do we punish hate by being hateful? Do we separate ourselves from those who separate themselves from us or others? Do we snip the threads of that interdependent web? Do we punish killers by killing them? My favorite statement of wisdom is not from the Bible. It is something our fellow congregant, Ron Reese, said years ago. Everyone wants to be accepted, but people are so judgmental. For me, that statement is like scripture. That's why I call it Ron 3:16. I don't know if Ron knows how many times I've quoted him. He's at home with Tommy after her surgery. But I spoke to him this week. Everyone wants to be accepted, but people are so judgmental. How do we live up to both challenges in that profound observation? How do we accept everyone? How do we not judge? How did the family members and friends in Charleston do it? How did they say, "We forgive," concerning a man who killed their loved ones and hadn't even asked for forgiveness? Forgiveness flows from an understanding of the unity of being. We are all in this together. We are one in being. We're part of something much larger than ourselves, our small individual selves. So here is our answer. Why would you partake of the same hatred that killed your loved one? Love pours balm into the wound of wounded humanity. Now, rather than just admiring these forgiving people, I hope we learn something from them, and in this learning, give meaning to their sacrifice. In our culture, we're a long way from understanding acceptance and unconditional love and forgiveness. We can admire the loved ones in Charleston and go on living our ways the same as before. And then we are like the rocky places where the seed sprang up but never took root. Or we can do something more profound than taking down a flag. We can be like the good soil where the seeds of forgiveness took root and multiply 30, 60, or even 100 times. Did you ever notice how some mothers still love their sons even after they commit atrocities? And I'm talking about more than breaking a glass on the kitchen floor. Do you see why we have to pour in extra love where there is an infection of hate? And I want to talk about a life that mattered. We've heard the statement that all lives matter, and that caused some controversy. We've heard the statement that black lives matter, and that addresses this other kind of atrocity we've seen so much recently, the profiling, the killing in custody or taking into custody of black suspects. One life that mattered. For decades, people wrangled about the Confederate flag on the State House dome and later a Confederate monument on the State House grounds. And then one day, a man infected with the most toxic strain of racism murdered Senator Clemente Pinckney and 8 others in a Bible study group. And almost overnight, many state representatives and senators who knew about and loved Clemente Pinckney changed their minds about that flag and said they were ready to take it down. And the latest surveys of those representatives and senators published in the Charleston News and Courier says there's actually a sufficient 2/3 majority to do it, and it might happen this week. Years of arguments on the head of a pin can leave us unmoved, while a single story about someone we know can change our hearts. All politics is about the heart. All the worst laws are grounded in fear, and all the best arguments will never remove the fear. Only love will remove the fear. And it's not some abstract love for all humanity. It's about loving one at a time. It's a very specific love. It's about a man named George loving his daughter Julie, her red hair, her pug nose, and the way she dances the tango. And that's what makes forgiveness so hard because some of the stories are horrible. How do you love a man when the only story you know about him is that he got some money from his father and bought a gun and went to Charleston and killed 9 people? Before we can love that man, we'll need a lot more stories. Mothers can love their sons who do some terrible things because they have other memories. They remember other times. They know more stories. But we don't know more stories about this man. We would need many more stories. And that's where I come to the poem by David Bates called Speak Gently. And I'm only going to read 2 out of many verses. Speak gently. It is better far to rule by love than fear. Speak gently. Let not harsh words mar the good we may do here. Speak gently to the erring. No, they may have toiled in vain. Perchance unkindness made them so. Oh, win them back again. So here's the context. Is that crazy talk to think about winning back a murderer? We may never know enough real stories about that man to make us love him. We may have to make up stories, if so inclined. Perchance unkindness made him so? That's a start. Withholding judgment, we can imagine more stories about unkindnesses that nudged him and he took a terrible wrong turn. It might take lots of stories to neutralize this toxic gruel in front of us, to stop this acid reflux of anger, but we need to stop it. No one is beyond redemption. That's the message of Jesus to me. We all need forgiveness. We all fall short at some point. Some of us fall shorter than others, and that's when we need more stories. I want your story. Your life matters. I can tell you in very specific ways how your life matters. It matters the way the life of Reverend Clemente Pinckney matters. It matters because your life is a story. Your life is a story, and it is the stories we know and tell about each other that change a people's hearts. 44 years ago, 2 men in Minnesota applied for a license to marry each other, but the courts said they couldn't. Some brave men and women persisted in seeking same-sex unions. And then in the 1980s came the AIDS crisis. And for many gay men, the anger and the love were more important than the warm, dark safety of the closet. And people started coming out. It was about that time that a congresswoman named Chenoweth said, "There are no homosexuals in Idaho." And there was another congressman in Idaho that came along later that maybe proved that wrong in an airport restroom. That seems laughable now because everyone knows some gay men and lesbians, but there was a time when people could realistically believe they did not know any homosexuals. Then the AIDS came, and anger and love, and today we know some stories. And the stories changed our hearts. My life as an openly gay man changed more hearts than anything I ever said or wrote in favor of same-sex marriage. It was all those hearts changed one at a time by the stories people saw that led to the acceptance of same-sex marriage. You're not going to change people's hearts by calling them idiots. In the South, we have strange stories. We're known for our stories. We're known for our short story writers, our novelists. But the strangest stories are tales that are So true, but so shameful, we barely tell them at all, even in a whisper. It is a bifurcated history of the South, and the story of slavery is a special challenge whose terrible chill haunts us to this day. Other nations had slaves, we're told. So, but those people were enslaved by conquest. The status of slaves said nothing about one's inherent worth. It was regarded as bad luck to end up a slave. But how do you justify or explain slavery in a nation founded upon the declaration that all are created equal and endowed by the Creator with the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? How can such a nation even justify slavery? The answer the slaveholders came up with was racism. Africans were inferior, they said. They said Africans were savage, uncivilized, not as smart. They needed the white men's help. The Europeans were doing the Africans a favor by bringing them to America and putting them to work dawn to dusk and teaching them Christianity. These racist lies were baked into the Southern culture. And when slavery was abolished, the racism persisted and gave rise to new institutions that replaced slavery with other means of domination and control. Sharecropping, chain gangs, segregation, lynching, the poll tax, racist jokes, racial profiling, and the war on drugs. So it's not all in the past, this terrible legacy of slavery and the racism that was invented to justify it. We still have racial profiling. We have a war on drugs that puts so many young black men in prison. We still have efforts to restrict minority voting. We're not going to fix all this by taking down a flag. People are still going to say hurtful things and commit terrible acts of violence. But we can move ahead. We can hear each other's stories, and we can remember the words of Ron Rees. Everyone wants to be accepted, but people are so judgmental.